in the matter of the registrant G.H. and the registrant G.A. Can we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Ms. Anderson, please go ahead. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you. It bears repeating that, as recognized by this Court, the purpose of the entire Megan's Law scheme of registration and notification, including subsection G, was to protect the public safety. In 1994, Megan Kanka was brutally raped and murdered by Jesse Temendiquas, a previously convicted sex offender who moved into her neighborhood. Megan's Law was enacted to prevent similar tragedies from occurring in the future by giving law enforcement, and in some cases the public, information regarding the whereabouts of sex offenders. Therefore, in New Jersey, sex offenders must register under Megan's Law for life unless they may seek termination of their registration requirements under the narrow exception created under 2C7-2F, subsection F. In Doe versus Poritz, this Court said, the registration and notification laws are not retributive laws, but are laws designed to give people a chance to protect themselves and their children. They do not represent the slightest departure from our state's or our country's fundamental belief that criminals, convicted and punished, have paid their debt to society and are not to be punished further. They represent only the conclusion that society has the right to know of their presence, not in order to punish them, but in order to protect itself. The law represents a conclusion by the legislature that those convicted sex offenders who have successfully, or apparently successfully, been integrated into their communities, adjusted their lives so as to appear no more threatening than anybody else in the neighborhood, are entitled not to be disturbed simply because of that prior offense and conviction. But a conclusion as well that the characteristics of some of them and the statistical information concerning them make it clear that despite such integration, reoffense is a realistic risk and knowledge of their presence a realistic protection against it. I would like to emphasize 3 points for Your Honors this afternoon. First, the plain language chosen in subsection G, specifically the phrase has been convicted, demonstrates the legislature's intent to apply subsection G to those offenders who were convicted before its passage in 2002. Simply put, on the day that subsection G became effective, it immediately applied to any offender who had been convicted, adjudicated delinquent, or acquitted by reason of insanity of a registrable offense. The registrants in these cases, and those similarly situated, fit that criteria. This Court, therefore, need not look beyond the plain language of subsection G to resolve the issue before it today. Second, the legislature is entitled to amend or change the laws in its acts at any time, as it did in this case. Despite the assertion that the legislature believed Megan's Law, as originally enacted in 1994, fully satisfied its public safety objectives, even though it permitted potential relief from registration requirements, the legislature clearly amended the statute to provide for certain offenders not to be allowed to seek termination, a benefit that was never guaranteed to any offender. Just as the extended statute of limitations for aggravated sexual assault of a minor under 13 were held to apply to a defendant whose time under the original statute of limitations had not yet run in Nagel, so to here, the registrants in these cases were not eligible for termination until well after subsection G had become law. Therefore, subsection G should apply to them. Finally, no manifest injustice occurs by applying subsection G to registrants who, like GH and GA, were convicted and placed on Megan's Law before its enactment in 2002. At no time were these registrants, or indeed any registrant in their position, under the impression that termination from registration was guaranteed. Again, under New Jersey law, it has always been true that all offenders must register under Megan's Law for life, unless they can demonstrate by preponderance of the evidence that they meet the narrow exception carved out by the legislature in F. This is a non-punitive measure designed for public safety and does not pose an undue burden on registrants. Indeed, the only thing that they are required to do under Megan's Law is register within a certain amount of time with their local law enforcement and provide notice to law enforcement if any of the information requested changes.
But why isn't it a manifest injustice to deny them the possibility of termination, which is what, before G came out, was the case? And at the time that they entered their pleas?
For several reasons, Your Honor, I'm specifically going to talk about four reasons. First, this court in Doe versus Poritz sanctioned the application of Megan's Law itself, the entire registration scheme, to offenders who, when they pled guilty or were convicted of their offense, did not know about Megan's Law because it did not exist at the time. So this court made very clear why.
We said it was remedial.
Correct.
But we said it was remedial in the context of then subsection F, which said that although we have lifetime registration, a person who is an offense-free for 15 years can apply for removal, provided that he or she is not likely to pose a threat to the safety of others.
Correct, Your Honor. So, but the overarching first point of my response being that if the entire Megan's Law registration scheme can apply to somebody who did not know that they would be subject to it at the time that they were convicted, it would be no different here than applying subsection G to registrants like GH and GA who were convicted prior to subsection G's enactment in 2002. The second reason termination for Megan's Law, as I said, was never guaranteed to any offender. When Megan's Law was first enacted in 1994, subsection F only carved out a very narrow exception. Not only does a person have to be offense-free, which means, as this court reaffirmed in, I believe it was AD, offense, not crime, not sex offense, but any offense as defined in the criminal code, they also had to demonstrate that they were not going to pose a threat to the safety of others. And especially given the people who are subject to registration under subsection G, this is not a foregone conclusion because these are the offenders who have committed more than one sex offense, the most serious sex offense.
But parole's not a foregone conclusion either. Can parole be repealed even though individuals at the time they pled guilty had in mind that they might one day qualify for it?
Your Honor brings up a good distinction. In that case, parole, and I would analogize under the Megan's Law, under the sex offender context, community supervision for life, parole supervision for life, is very clearly distinct from Megan's Law, which is non-punitive in nature. All of the restrictions that might be associated with Megan's Law are actually part of if an offender is subject to community supervision for life or parole supervision for life.
But you're saying it's non-punitive.
Right.
So we know Doe versus Poritz said that F is non-punitive. F had a 15-year, I'll call it a buyout, provided a person offense-free for 15 years and no longer posed a danger to the public. Here we have potentially people who, after 15 years, okay, will pose no danger to the public whatsoever, will be fully rehabilitated, and yet will be subject to this registration scheme. What remedial purpose does that serve? And why doesn't that constitute a punitive act when it has nothing to do with public safety or rehabilitation?
2 points in response to Your Honor's question. First of all, the legislature determined that this was the policy for these certain offenders who, again, have committed more than one sex offense or who have committed the most egregious sex offenses. I'd like to also just make very clear the non-punitive nature by just reiterating what is required by Megan's Law. Megan's Law does not restrict where an offender lives. An offender can be on Megan's Law and live next door to an elementary school. An offender is not restricted as to where they work. The only restriction placed on this in Megan's Law is that they cannot be a part of a youth-serving organization.
What is, after the offender has been totally rehabilitated, assume that, okay, and no longer poses any danger to the public, as would be determined by a judge, what is the remaining remedial purpose as opposed to punitive? How could that not be considered punitive?
Because the burdens placed, there is no undue burden on the offender. All of the restrictions that might make something punitive are not based on Megan's Law. They're based on community supervision for life.
So I'm going to quote something from CK, and you can, and I know it's for juveniles, so it's distinct from this, and I just want you to comment on it with respect to this line of questioning. So we said this, when in the case of juveniles, the remedial purpose of Megan's Law, rehabilitation of the offender and protection of the public, is satisfied, then the continued constraints on their lives and liberty pursuant to subsection G, long after they have become adults, takes on a punitive aspect that cannot be justified by our Constitution. Now, I know that we said that with respect to juveniles, but at least with respect to ex post facto retroactivity, why isn't that true here? Why doesn't it have the same penal sting for an adult who has been thoroughly rehabilitated and found to be not a danger to the public? Go ahead.
Again, two responses. First of all, just to be clear, the policy behind Megan's Law is not for rehabilitation of the offender. It is for the protection of the public. So therefore, it is not dependent on the rehabilitation of the offender.
Can I stop you there? You began your argument with that overarching statement as well, that this is about protection of public safety. How is that aim defeated if an individual as to whom there's been a finding is not likely to pose a threat, no longer reports?
Again, I would point out, Your Honors, that this is a determination that is made by the legislature that these specific class of offenders who have A, committed more than one sex offense, and B, committed the couple of very serious offenses enumerated in subsection G, continue to apply for life, which was always the default in the state.
So we know that the legislature has included this for the purpose, as I understand it, of protecting federal funding. You're arguing public safety. And my question is, how is public safety undermined if the last clause of F, that this person is not likely to pose a threat, has been demonstrated?
And again, to kind of tie this together with Your Honor's question, in terms of the funding, the legislature could have chosen to either make this applicable to offenders who were convicted after subsection G was enacted or before subsection G was enacted to keep federal funding. And by the plain language that they chose in the statute, has been convicted, they made the public safety determination that these offenders, even if they were enacted, even if they were convicted before subsection G was enacted, that the public safety necessitates knowing law enforcement knowing where these offenders are.
But you're reading that into G. There's certainly nothing in the legislative history that supports that.
Your Honor, the legislative history is a little bit sparse, I will say, but we don't need to get there because the plain language, plus the fact that this became immediately effective, means that on the day that subsection G became effective, it applied to any offender who has been convicted. Not is convicted, not will be convicted, but has been convicted. And so therefore, it applied, just based on the face of the language chosen itself, to offenders like GH and GA, who, when subsection G became enacted, had been convicted of these qualifying or disqualifying from termination offenses.
Is the public safety argument that the judge might be wrong in the assessment? Isn't that what it has to come down to?
That is certainly a possibility, Your Honor. And I would say that the public safety as well, these types of crimes are very underreported. As we have seen based on the public news, the news cycle for the past, I would say, few years has, case after case where, these crimes can very much go underreported. And so, again, a determination by the legislature that these offenders, specifically those who either committed, the two predicate sex offenses mentioned or more than one sex offense, we want to know where they are. And if I just can go back to, again...
If I can interrupt you.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
If we apply this prospectively, isn't the question of public safety moot? So we have a small body of people who are going to be, who before G would have been, could avail themselves of the 15 years and no further registration. After that, according to this legislation, anything going forward, there will be no 15-year look, and G will apply. So we're just talking about a small body of people who entered guilty pleas based on the knowledge that after 15 years, they had the possibility of appearing before a judge and getting taken off any registration obligations.
Your Honor, just to pick up on your question, I would also note that at no time was termination guaranteed to any offender. And in fact, if you look at the plea forms that are used for Megan's Law offenders going back, even when GH and GA were convicted of their initial sex offenses, they do not mention anything that I can see about termination. So it was never, there was never even a mention in the plea negotiations of, well, you might be able to terminate after 15 years. It was strictly, do you understand that you will have to register under this act? And I will also point out, in response to Your Honor's question, that obviously Megan's Law is not negotiable as part of the time frame in which to register does not factor into plea negotiations. Either you are on Megan's Law or you are not.
How do we address the plain language of 2G? It says a person required to register on this section who has been convicted, not who is convicted, but has been. So just past tense to me.
Correct.
How do we address the plain language of that under the interpretation that the defendants seek?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that in the appellate division opinion, they acknowledge that the use of this, the panel acknowledged that the use of this language indicates that it applies to an event that has already happened, meaning the conviction. So I would agree with Your Honor's assessment that by the plain language itself, this applies to anyone who, on the date that it immediately became effective.
If the plain language is clear and unambiguous, do we need to get to the legislative history? Isn't that where our inquiry ends?
I would agree with that, Your Honor. Yes. I do not think legislative intent is necessary to answer this question. I think it's answerable on the face of the language chosen by the legislature itself.
Do you concede that in the past, whenever the legislature has used effective date language that says this act shall take effect immediately, that that language has been given prospective effect?
Certainly, in general, laws are read to be prospective, but I would also emphasize that we're talking about registrants who already are on Meggitt's Law, so the question is termination. And therefore, the event that this stat subsection deals with has not occurred yet.
Well, that's where there's maybe some ambiguity, but the Appellate Division decision points out that, and we know that G was added by our legislature to ensure New Jersey's compliance with future federal funding, that the federal law did not require states to impose registration requirements, including this one, retroactively, or that they couldn't change what they had. At page 21 of slip opinion, they cited a Ninth Circuit opinion that recognized that the federal government was interested in future applications of this no elimination of registration requirement for persons convicted twice or more.
Correct, Your Honor. Certainly, I would not dispute that for purposes of federal funding, the federal government gave states the option to
right.
choose.
Right.
And certainly,
if our legislature was doing this amendment for the purpose of ensuring federal funding, knowing that the federal government didn't require this elimination of this back look, why is it so clear that the who has been convicted of language was meant to be applied the way that you're suggesting?
Thank you, Your Honor. I understand your question, and I would point to the language in subsection A of Meggitt's Law, which is the exact same language used and which this court has been given effect to apply the registration scheme in Doe versus Ports to those offenders who have been convicted prior to Meggitt's Law becoming effective. So,
the 7.2B1 shows that the legislature knew how to add the additional language that says regardless of when the commission of the offense occurred, they knew how to be specific about earlier in time convictions when they wanted to.
So I think the distinction, Your Honor, is that subsection A defines who has to register. It's who has been convicted of a sex offense as defined in subsection B. And in B1, and in subsection B, Your Honor is right, there are the legislature does point to different time frames and effective date and regardless of the commission of the offense or date of conviction. However, that is dealing with who has to register at all. It doesn't, it wouldn't make sense in terms of a subsection that talks about termination to break it down in that same way because everyone who is looking at subsection G has already been placed on Meggitt's Law, and it's just a question of...
Well, G is going to apply indefinitely into the future as long as it remains on the books. So it has to read who has been convicted, doesn't it? What other tense would you use?
No, Your Honor, if the legislature wanted to apply it to sex offenders who had been convicted after 2002, they may have used language that said, has been convicted as of the effective date.
Who is convicted? Would that be helpful?
Or who is convicted. Exactly.
Who is would be the same thing. It would be more like who was convicted
following the effective date of the statute would be the language that you would
correct,
see.
Your Honor. Correct, Your Honor. And so, in looking at the retroactive application of Megan's Law to offenders who had previously not known that they would be subject to it, along with the plain word choice, the legislature's intent was clear to apply this to any offender who, when this became immediately effective, who has been convicted, and certainly GH and GA and registrants similarly situated fit that criteria.
Can I ask you a question with respect to A1 and B1 issues? If A1 is retroactive language, and that's what you argue, right? A1?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. If A1 is retroactive, why was it necessary for the legislature in B1 to add the language regardless of the date of the commission of the offense of the date of conviction? I'm trying to figure out, like, why would the legislature have done that?
Because subsection A talks about who must register under this act, and so subsection B...
So A is saying everyone, past and present, right?
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Certainly,
okay,
it's
okay,
the
so
same language
okay.
has been confirmed.
So what does B1 add into the class of people before and after?
Because, Your Honor, the subsection B defines who has to register, and so subsection B is also talking about who has to start to register, and I think this court did make a determination that, certainly not every single offender.
Well, everyone, look, tell me if I'm mistaken. Everyone in A1
right.
is in B1, yes? Is there anyone in A1 that's not in B1? The class of A1 is B1 as well, includes it.
Correct.
Okay, so A has been convicted. You're saying that is retroactive. I'm trying to figure out in B1 why in that category, which included characterized by a pattern of repetitive compulsive behavior, that they specifically said regardless of the date of the commission of the offense of the date of conviction.
Correct. And I think, again, the distinction is because subsection B is talking about registering in the first place versus termination. So,
one can argue, looking at A1 and B1,
mm-hmm.
that the legislature wanted to make certain that the people who were engaged in a pattern of repetitive compulsive behavior, those people, regardless of the date of the offense, you're on the registry, and actually distinguishing it from the general people in A1. No? Isn't that a common sense interpretation of language?
Correct, Your Honor, but if we talk about termination, the distinction is, and I think this kind of gets to the nuance between, the while there is some instructive, while it is instructive that they chose the same languages in subsection A, the distinction is with termination, they're talking about an event that has not happened yet. In other words, GH and GA, both subsection G was passed well before they were eligible for termination. I think if you're talking about somebody who pled guilty, did not know that they were on Megan's Law, and then is now having to register under subsection A, and even that was okay, it would be a little different because of termination. Now, it's not the case that, for example, GH and GA had applied for termination, were off of Megan's Law, and now subsection G gets passed, and now they have
to
register.
So I understand that argument.
Re-register.
But if, hypothetically,
mm-hmm.
if G, with its lifetime irrevocable, okay, no public safety exception, constituted a penal sanction, you agree that then the ex post facto provision would apply, correct?
Your Honor, I would actually, because you've brought up the ex post facto issue, I would like to, we actually asked that this court save that issue for another case because...
So I accept that. Now let's see if you can answer the hypothetical. I know that you don't want us to answer that, but that goes into whether or not we should engage in constitutional avoidance, which is being argued. It's the reason why I'm asking you that question. So just assume for the hypothetical that G, because it's lifetime, no public safety exception, is penal. Would the ex post facto then be triggered, if that were the case?
That would be a different question, Your Honor. And of course, my response, as you can probably predict, is that subsection G and all of the Megan's Law scheme is not penal in nature.
But you're not answering my assume, just for the sake of the argument, if it were penal, would that trigger the ex post facto clause?
No, Your Honor, because, I think we're not talking about GH and GA were terminated from Megan's Law, and then they had to come back on because subsection G was enacted. And again, I would ask this court to save that issue for a different case for a number of reasons. One of them being that this issue was not briefed by the parties in the appellate division. In fact, it was agreed that...
I want to go back then to A1 and B1, the language there with a follow-up question. Your position on A1 is the use of the language, who has been convicted, tells us that this is retroactive, correct?
At least is instructive. At least, in other words, the plain language of subsection G... And looking at it in the context of this whole Megan's Law scheme, which this court sanctioned as being applied to offenders who were convicted before it was enacted.
That was the easy part of the question.
Okay.
Accepting your argument and that language means retroactive.
Yes,
so then, look at B1. If the clause that we've been discussing at the very end, regardless of the date of commission of the offense or the date of conviction, were removed, would you read the statute any differently?
Would I read subsection G differently?
Would you have a different view on the retroactive application and the import of the phrase that you are resting on?
No, Your Honor, because again, if taking that phrase has been convicted, I would say that would still then on the effective date of this statute apply to anyone who has been convicted.
So it seems as though the legislature may have had something in mind. You don't want to render this language superfluous. They thought that it belonged there, the language at the end of B1, which I don't see you giving any meaning to.
And again, Your Honor, I would point to the distinction between, who has to go on Megan's Law might be a little bit of a different consideration in terms of how they break it down specifically in subsection B, how the legislature chose to. But in terms of termination, here we are. All of the offenders looking at subsection G are on Megan's Law. And the need for... breaking it down like that is not necessary, and I would just again say if you...
Is your answer to the Chief Justice's question is that the language is superfluous?
I would just say that the language in subsection A is...
No, I'm asking about language in B1. Regardless of the date, given your interpretation of A1, is the language, regardless of the date of the commission of the offense, is that language superfluous?
No, Your Honor. I would just say that indicates that the legislature is, has given some application to offenders by using the phrase "has been convicted." They acknowledge that that phrase, among other groups of people, applies to offenders who have been convicted of the, regardless of the offense. So I think that this demonstrates actually that the phrase "has been convicted" in subsection A, they knew that it would have some application to those offenders who weren't previously subject to Megan's Law, and they were able to use that phrase again in subsection G to affect the statute this way.
Can I go back to some of the language discussing what we should understand about this federal requirement that is being implemented in G? And again, I'm coming back to the Appellate Division's decision because it's very succinct and pithy in discussing this. But the Appellate Division says, look, the Wetterling Act neither requires states accepting funds to impose registration requirements retroactively on individuals previously convicted of sex offenses, nor precluded states from imposing any new registration requirements on offenders convicted prior. So when you look at our scheme as it existed before the 2002 amendments,
correct,
and our scheme for registration was you have to register, but if you serve your 15 years and show that you're not a danger to the public and you're offense-free, that registration requirement can be discontinued by order of the court. So do we look at the change to our scheme that G affects as imposing a new requirement?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because, again, registration by default was always lifetime. And so it doesn't change that general requirement. The only thing that subsection G did to amend,
but it wasn't airtight that it would be lifetime.
Correct.
It was understood whether you pled or whether you were convicted that you had the opportunity after 15 clean years to make that application and secure freedom from registration requirements. That was our scheme. Now, to the extent it's being changed, is that not imposing new registration requirement on people who were previously convicted or pled to a Megan's Law offense that triggered this requirement, and now has it changed after 2002?
No, Your Honor, I would just say that it now makes that narrow exception in subsection F inapplicable for a certain class of offenders, mm-hmm, those who have, committed either one of two predicate offenses or more than one sex offense. So it didn't change any registration requirements. It didn't add anything new. It made subsection F inapplicable to a certain...
I understand that that's your preferred reading, but what compels us to agree with it?
Because the actual requirements and what the registrants had to do doesn't change, and it didn't change, again, the fact that they knew that there was a possibility that they would be registering for life under this act.
I'm sorry. No. Please finish.
I understand your answer.
Thank you.
How do you square your position with the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in St. Cyr, where the facts are a little different, but the situation is very much the same? And in that case, the Supreme Court looked at a deportation agreement where the defendant entered a plea agreement with the expectation that they would be eligible for discretionary relief from deportation. New statute comes up that takes that all away, and the Supreme Court says there's a clear difference for the purposes of retroactivity analysis between facing possible deportation and facing certain deportation. Isn't that the situation we have here?
I would distinguish it, Your Honor, in the following way. Again, I would say that the context is certainly different. Again, this is a civil, non-punitive, and I apologize that I'm not more clear on the details of that case. But again, I would also say that this is a case of subsection G being passed in 2002 before any eligibility for termination by GHGA and those similarly situated.
Is that different from St. Cyr?
Again, I apologize that I'm not more familiar with the details, but again, this is about the public safety, and again, this court has already, to quote this court, the Constitution does not prevent society from attempting to protect itself from convicted sex offenders, no matter when convicted, so long as the means of protection are reasonably designed for that purpose, and for the purpose of protecting the public. And it really weighed the balance. This court in Doe versus Ports really weighed the balance of fairness to the registrants and fairness to the public, and weighed those two interests. And and said that it was, that it was okay to apply Megan's Law to offenders who pled guilty before it was in effect.
Other questions, anyone? Is there anything you'd like to add at this point, Ms. Sanders?
Yes, Your Honor. I would just like to, again, emphasize that we would ask this court to hold off on deciding on ruling on any ex post facto arguments, as we feel they're not properly before the court for multiple reasons.
Understood. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Your Honor.
Ms. Lund. And with three able counsel on this side, I'm going to invite you to incorporate one another's arguments as we proceed to the extent that makes sense.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. New Jersey law presumes that new statutes apply prospectively as a matter of fundamental fairness. The United States Supreme Court has recognized that the presumption of prospectivity has timeless and universal human appeal. That presumption can only be overcome by the clearest statement of legislative intent that demonstrates the legislature affirmatively considered the potential for unfairness in retroactive application, and decided that that unfairness was an acceptable price to pay for the law's benefits. But even then, even when the legislature makes a clear, unequivocal statement of intent for retroactivity, this court will not apply a new law retroactively if doing so would result in manifest injustice. Manifest injustice exists when an individual changed their position in reliance on the existing law. And it also exists when the new law removes all remedies. Now, the state argues that subsection G should retroactively strip registrants of any opportunity to terminate Megan's Law, even when they relied on that opportunity when they entered their plea agreements, even if they no longer pose a risk to the public, and even if the legislative intent behind subsection G is fully realized without retroactive application. The state's position is at odds with fairness and due process. The phrase "has been convicted" in subsection G doesn't even come close to meeting this court's high standard for clarity that it applies to the legislature when the legislature wants to express intent for retroactivity. Has been convicted is a legal term of art. It's used throughout the criminal code to describe predicate offenses. If the legislature wanted subsection G to apply retroactively, it would have said so. It would have said subsection G applies regardless of the date of conviction. The fact that the legislature didn't use that phrase, regardless of the date of conviction, or any other phrase, to connote retroactivity in subsection G is clear evidence that the legislature did not want subsection G to apply retroactively. But again, even if it had, even if the legislature said G applies regardless of the date of conviction, this court could not give subsection G retroactive effect because registrants relied on existing law when they entered their plea agreements. The integrity of plea bargaining is essential to the criminal justice system. It would certainly be unjust for the state to change the consequences of plea bargaining years later, sometimes decades later, especially because the change that they seek removes any opportunity for a remedy or recourse for the rest of the registrant's life. Registrants like GH and GA, they relied on subsection F when they pled guilty. They understood that if they remained offense-free for 15 years and if they rehabilitated themselves, they would have an opportunity to terminate Megan's Law. And often I would say that registrants relied on their counsel, and sometimes they relied on the assurances of the court during the plea hearing or at sentencing. If registrants or criminal defendants can't rely on the advice of counsel or on the assurances of the court, then the integrity of the criminal justice system will be diminished in New Jersey. This court can avoid that result by holding that subsection G does not apply retroactively. And with that, I'll be happy to answer the court's questions.
You talked about the reliance aspect of it. Couldn't all of those arguments, and weren't all those arguments made about Megan's Law at the time of Doe versus Poritz, and weren't they rejected by this court?
They were, Your Honor.
So what distinguishes, obviously, probably a much larger group of individuals who had pled guilty to sex offenses before they ever heard of Megan or Megan's Law from these individuals who were generally aware of, presumed to be generally aware of Megan's Law, but didn't know about this coming twist in Megan's Law?
Well, Your Honor, of course, we have the legislative intent was different with the original Megan's Law enactment. We know that the legislature enacted subsection G to avoid the loss of federal funding. Also, we know that the legislature clearly expressed intent for the retroactivity of the original enactment, but it hasn't done so with subsection G. But more importantly, I think to Your Honor's question, subsection, with respect to reliance, subsection F mitigated that unfairness that Your Honor, I think, is getting to. Subsection F recognized that when a person is no longer a threat to the safety of others, the remedial purpose of Megan's Law is no longer served, and so they can terminate their requirements. Of course, subsection G has no individualized consideration of risk. Subsection G removes that provision in the original enactment that mitigated the unfairness.
But in terms of just in terms of the reliance argument, because that's really to the core of your brief, it's the core of your argument, is that these individuals pled guilty at a time when this was when there was that 15-year look back.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the arguments or the rationale by which the court rejected that argument up front in the beginning of Megan's Law would apply here. Just focusing on reliance, and I understand the distinctions in terms of legislative history and the timing and so forth. But if it was not unfair, fundamentally unfair, to impose Megan's Law on individuals who were convicted before Megan's Law ever existed anywhere, then why is it fundamentally unfair in this situation?
Because in this situation, we're talking about a lifetime requirement with no recourse. The original Megan's Law included subsection F, which mitigated that unfairness.
Doe versus Poritz ever say anything about subsection F and Megan's Law being anything other than a lifetime requirement?
Well, it did, Your Honor, indirectly. Doe says that Megan's Law requirements are lifetime unless the registrant can remain offense-free for 15 years and prove that he's not likely to pose a threat to the safety of others. So I don't think Doe, or certainly
that,
the...
That language you just mentioned, because I'm really, this is an open-ended question from my standpoint. The language you just mentioned, that's in the Doe opinion. It specifically relied on the fact that 15 years of arrest-free and rehab, you can get back in.
I'm not sure if it specifically relied on that language. That language is in Doe. Doe describes the duration of the registration requirement. I'm not sure, Your Honor, if it specifically says F mitigates the unfairness
because
of this.
Because I thought it specifically said throughout it was a lifetime registration requirement, which would be inconsistent with your argument.
Well, again, it doesn't say it's a lifetime requirement full stop. It says it's a lifetime requirement unless the registrant can prove. So that's very different than saying it's what subsection G does. It's a lifetime requirement with no opportunity for relief.
Why are you fighting this reliance argument, which seems to be very weak based upon the questions that Justice Patterson is presenting to you? It seems to me the way you're responding is that G is penal in nature, and that's what distinguishes it from F, and that's what makes this completely different. Go ahead.
Well,
I've thrown the ball to you.
Typical hanging curveball in baseball.
So if I understand Your Honor's point, I mean, We didn't bring the ex post facto challenge in this case.
But you're arguing constitutional avoidance, so you can argue that you're trying to avoid that particular outcome.
Yes,
so
and the friends of the court have made that argument. I think certainly if this court rules that subsection G is retroactive, I shouldn't say certainly, it's very likely that there will be registrants in the near future that bring the ex post facto challenge and that say that because this is mandatory lifetime with no connection whatsoever to risk, as the original Megan's Law was, did the court in Doe went to great lengths to ensure that the original enactment was carefully calibrated to this risk assessment. Subsection G doesn't do that. So I certainly think there is the punitive question.
Didn't really the court in Doe say, politely, too bad that we have to make this retroactive, otherwise the public safety aspects of the statute are not going to work. And wasn't that really the response of the Doe court to that argument?
It was, Your Honor, but we are in 2000, the circumstances in 2002 when G was passed were very different than in 1994 when the original enactment was passed. In 1994, there was no, Megan's Law didn't exist. So we went from having zero protection from sex offenders to having this new law. In order for that law to have any effect on the date it was enacted, the legislature felt that it had to make it retroactive in order to protect the public.
Because they said it was remedial. And they made it retroactive because it was remedial. And if G were remedial, then it could also have the same retroactive application without violating the ex post facto law, correct?
Correct.
And that's where your reliance argument completely falls apart unless G has some sort of penal sting to it. No? Are you following me?
I think so, Your Honor. But I don't think the reliance argument, I don't think you have to get to penal in order for this reliance argument to hold weight.
Well, it didn't work in Doe versus Poritz because the court, even though people who pled guilty had no idea that the legislature was going to pass this registration act, they were still bound by it. Our court found it was retroactive because it was not a penal statute. It was remedial in nature, and therefore it applied retroactively. Had the Doe court decided otherwise, Justice Stein was dissenting and found that it was penal, then it would have violated the ex post facto law.
Yes.
Look, you're not making a penal argument. Isn't your best argument the one that you are advancing, which is that this does not meet the clarity required for a retroactive application of legislative intent expressed in the statute.
Yes, Your Honor, and certainly the appellate division recognized that as well and accepted that position.
Right.
And that's basically a constitutional avoidance.
Correct.
That has to be clear and unambiguous.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Anything you'd like to add?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Haas.
May it please the Court. The ACLU of New Jersey agrees with respondents that there's only one reasonable reading of the plain text of subsection G, and that is that it applies prospectively only. However, if the Court is not fully convinced by that plain text argument, the ACLU also believes there's a secondary reason why the Court should read the statute prospectively, which is to avoid a serious constitutional question under the ex post facto clause. In order to invoke this doctrine of constitutional avoidance, there is no need for the Court to actually find that retroactive application would, in fact, violate the ex post facto clause. Rather, there need only be a finding that retroactivity would open the door to a legitimate argument on that front. And the ACLU believes there certainly is such an argument, and we laid it out in detail in our briefing why applying subsection G to registrants like GA and GH would be in violation of the ex post facto clause. I'm happy to answer any questions the Court might have about that argument, but if not, I'd like to just quickly address the two points that the State made in its supplemental briefing regarding why the ex post facto clause is not implicated here. The first was a point regarding retroactivity, and the second was a point regarding punitiveness, the two requirements for a statute to have violated the ex post facto clause. So turning first to retroactivity, the State incorrectly argues that application to GH and GA would not be retroactive because they were not eligible to and did not apply to terminate the registration until after subsection G was passed. However, this misunderstands the deets that are relevant to an ex post facto clause analysis. In Riley, quoting the United States Supreme Court, this court said that a law violates the ex post facto clause if it makes more burdensome the punishment for a crime after its commission. So there's only two dates relevant in an ex post facto analysis: the date the original crime was committed and the date the law increasing the punishment for that crime was passed. If the crime was committed before the relevant law was passed, there is retroactivity. The fact that the termination application took place afterwards isn't relevant for purposes of the ex post facto clause. And I think this court has recognized a similar principle in an analogous case, the recent case Hester, regarding violations of supervised release conditions. In that case, this court recognized that even if a supervised release violation takes place after a statute is passed increasing the punishment for that violation, as long as the original crime which subjected the person to supervised release took place before the statute was passed, there's still an ex post facto problem there. So even though there is this kind of two-step inquiry going on here, the ex post facto clause still measures retroactivity based on the date of the original crime. And here there's no dispute that GH and GA committed the relevant crimes well before subsection G was passed. So the retroactivity point, I think, is clearly met here, and the ex post facto clause would be implicated by application to GH and GA.
Let me ask you a question. It's a point you raised about the legislative history in your brief. You're saying that the legislative history is not remedial, it's not punitive, it's just federal funding. And that got me thinking about statutes, some of them actually dealing with sex offenders, where federal funding is made contingent on the passage, a state passage of conforming state laws.
Yes.
Does the fact that the states maybe got down to business to make sure their federal funding was ensured mean that the legislature is solely focused on federal funding, or is there a legislative intent to enhance public safety, for example, as well? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So I certainly think it's possible that a legislature could have, you know, both intents in mind simultaneously. I think the legislative history here doesn't really make that particularly likely in this case. And I think in CK, the court did recognize that the primary motivation here was that federal funding. But I also think, you know, in the intent effects test that is relevant to ex post facto analysis, intent is only the first step. So even if it were to be the case that the legislature here did have a remedial intent, we would still have to turn to the effects of the statute to determine whether or not it was punitive.
Presumably, if the federal government, for whatever reason, was making federal funding contingent on a legislative policy that our legislature was just anathema to our legislature, we're not going to adopt that even if we lose funding, it wouldn't pass the law, the conforming law. I mean, seems to me an implication that the legislature finds the statute to be consistent with its public policy, or it wouldn't pass it, even if we're going to lose federal funding by not passing it. Can we assume that as well?
I certainly think you can assume that the legislature, you know, did intend to pass the law that it did pass and found it to be acceptable, but I think the point we were trying to make in our briefing was that, you know, in ex post facto analysis, there's the notion that if the legislature has a clear remedial intent, then you need to show the highest proof that the effects are, in fact, punitive to overcome that intent. And, you know, we think that could be the case here. However, we wanted to argue that given that the intent here was not clearly remedial, it wasn't punitive, but it wasn't clearly remedial either, perhaps there's no need to meet that much higher standard when showing the punitive effects. But again, even if the intent of the legislature was clearly remedial here, it's still possible for the law to violate the ex post facto clause because of the severity of the effects.
So are we treating statutes that are passed because the federal government is pressing the states to pass them differently for purposes of this analysis than we are statutes the state just comes up with over in the state house on its own?
I don't think there's a need to. I think that other jurisdictions that have passed a similar Megan's Law updates in response to federal legislation have included multiple reasons in their legislative history when making those amendments, have included public safety type reasons. But again, I don't think the ex post facto argument depends on whether or not the legislature did have a public safety purpose here. Even if it did, it could still be an ex post facto violation.
But even if it does have, if it does state a public safety purpose, isn't that giving it a remedial content that might resolve the ex post facto problem?
I don't think that can resolve the ex post facto issue on its own because of the intent effects test. So even if it's very clear that the legislature has a remedial intent, even if it was very clearly stated in the statute for purposes of public safety, we're enacting subsection G, nonetheless, in order to complete an ex post facto analysis, after determining intent, the court must also turn to effects and go through the Mendoza-Martinez factors to analyze whether or not those effects are so severe that they should be punitive regardless of...
And that's what you do in your brief.
Absolutely.
You basically assume, okay, even if the legislature intended this to be remedial, when we look at the effects, when you look through the Supreme Court's criteria, constitute a penal statute.
Exactly, Your Honor. We do think that's the case. And that actually brings me to the second point that the state made in response to the notion that the ex post facto clause could be implicated here, which was that in other jurisdictions where amendments like this one, which made a previously existing Megan's Law scheme harsher, in other states where those types of laws has been found to be an ex post facto problem, typically the original law was less harsh than Megan's Law, or Megan's Law in New Jersey. For instance, some of these laws, the registrant in question would have automatically gotten off after 10 years, and then the law was amended such that they will be on the registry for life now. Here, of course, as the state has pointed out, our original law was different. The default was always that the registrant would be on the registry for life unless they were able to successfully apply for termination under subsection F. However, I think the state's point here misunderstands what matters about the amendment. The question isn't the distance between the old law and the new law, how much more harsh has it become, but rather, is the final law, the law that's present now, is that law passing the threshold of severity to become punitive? So Megan's Law, as this court found in Doe v. Poritz, as originally enacted, was remedial, but perhaps it was closer to the line where a law would become punitive than the laws in these other states. But what matters is not that distance. What matters is that, in our view, subsection G has clearly now gone over that line and is severe to the point that it should be considered punitive. Unless the court has any other questions, I'd simply urge you to affirm the decision below. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. The arguments of the ACLU have largely been addressed. So unless the court has questions, I did just want to note, Judge Solomon asked a question earlier of Ms. Lutz, and at page 21 in Doe, the court did speak to the language and cite to that language from subsection F, and did consider the exit ramp, so to speak, of the original Megan's Law statute as being a part of the remedial scheme in that a registrant who no longer posed a risk had an exit ramp. What subsection G does, as has been discussed here today, is it removes that exit ramp and no longer is registration, at least for those registrants who fall within the provisions of subsection G, tied to risk. And so therein lies the issue, according to the ACLU, is that once registration is not tied to risk, now the question of is it punishment comes up. And as this court suggested or held in CK, where registration is not tied to risk, it seems to lend itself to punishment, which would raise constitutional issues that can be avoided by accepting the arguments of the Public Defender Office as well as accepted by the Appellate Division. Unless the court has questions, the ACLU would ask this court to affirm and avoid these constitutional questions.
You're speaking for the ACDL.
ACDL, yes. I apologize.
I want them to know that if they listen to start.
ACDL, yes. Thank
all
you.
All those A's and C's. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Anderson.
Thank you, Your Honors, and I would just like to make four, I promise, brief points in rebuttal. First, as in regards to the ex post facto issue, as discussed before, I'd like to explain the five reasons why this issue is not properly before the court, and as suggested by the defense counsel, would be better suited for consideration in another argument. First, the registrants did not raise this issue in the appellate division. Indeed, they conceded, they did not raise these issues in the appellate division. In fact, they did not address that at all. Second, the appellate division did not consider this issue when rendering its decision. Specifically, in footnote 3, I believe it is, the appellate division noted that it was not considering this issue as it had not been raised by either party. Third, the state did not raise this issue in its petition. Fourth, the registrants did not cross-petition on this issue. And fifth, as stated in JR, this court does not consider arguments that are not properly before it by a party. So for all of those reasons, I would ask that this court save the ex post facto decision for another case where it can be more thoroughly briefed from the trial court through this court. Secondly, I would like to just very quickly distinguish Hester because it was brought up. Hester is obviously talking about criminal penalties for failing a condition of community supervision for life or parole supervision for life. And so therefore, it is clearly distinguishable from Megan's Law where we're not talking about anyone who has, incurred a criminal penalty. And so the distinguishing factor being this court has recognize that CSL and PSL place restrictions on registrants that make it different from Megan's Law, and therefore Hester is distinguishable. Third, I'd like to just briefly address the argument about legislative history. Justice Patterson, you asked about federal funding and could the legislature have had two purposes in mind? I would say two things to this. One, we don't need to look at the legislative intent because our argument is, of course, that the plain language of the statute ends the inquiry and it applies subsection G, knowing the words that they chose, imparting their intent on them based on the words that they chose, the legislature applied subsection G to any registrant who has been convicted when it became immediately effective in 2002. Just the other point about this in terms of the legislative intent, to look at Megan's Law as an overarching statutory scheme. This is not something in isolation. This was merely an amendment to a scheme that had an established purpose behind it, that was the purpose being to protect the public safety.
So the legislative statement that is appended to the bill specifically explains the desire not to lose federal funding. Does it offer another reason as the legislature's intent?
I would just what I mean by this, Your Honor,
is
that
answer my question.
the legislative intent or the legislative statement does not necessarily speak to any other intent specifically with subsection G. But of course, A, again, I don't. It's the state's position that we don't need to go there. And B, implicit in all of this is the legislature's overarching purpose in passing Megan's Law for public safety reasons. The final point that I would just like to make in terms of any reliance on subsection F by offenders like GH and GA and whether that might be manifestly unjust is that their remedy, if they had relied on the possibility of termination, their remedy would have been to seek to withdraw their plea at that time. We know that they did not rely on this or should not have relied on this because no mention of termination was ever made in any of the plea forms that I have found at the various dates that they have been amended. And so there should have been no expectation about anything relating to termination as part of the plea agreements.
That's the plea forms. I mean, how do we know there isn't discussion with counsel that explains how it works and you're going to have this 15-year, and if you are offense-free at 15 years, you can go before a judge and have this lifted. I mean, I don't think we should, or should we, take plea forms as the be-all and end-all of what people were relying on?
I guess my point is, Your Honor, is that at no point should any registrant have been relying on this termination because, again, A, it was not in the plea forms, but B, we also know that it was not a guarantee and it was never a guarantee.
No, but I mean, that the fact is someone could have, we don't know, we don't have any evidence either way, but someone could have had that explained by his lawyer. This is how it's going to work. It's apart from the plea form, even including the fact that it wasn't for sure.
And then that might have been a possible ineffective assistance of counsel claim. I don't know how far that would get, but...
Well, presumably, the attorney told the client what the law was. Whether it's on the plea form or not, your argument really is over here. Even if they relied on it, it doesn't make a difference.
Correct.
Because your argument is that G is remedial. So what's the difference?
Correct. And I would just, and I promise this is my last point, I would just emphasize the non-punitive nature of registration, that it is once a year for most offenders in a non-public area of their local PD. It does not, Megan's Law does not restrict where they live. what they do, except for working with a youth-serving organization, how much they can access the internet. There are the only parts of Megan's Law which are they're plainly in the name of the statute. It's the notification and registration. So the registration requirements keep us informed of this information, you know, your address, your any workplace that you have, and update us when it is at certain times. And so it does not place any undue restrictions on the offenders in terms of, them living their lives, going to school, working, again, except for the youth-serving organizations, accessing the internet. Those restrictions are not part of Megan's Law.
Thank you, counsel.
Just leave you with that.
And thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. Can I move on to the disciplinary matters?